You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Three letters today about the American macro economy. Any guesses? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 26th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So you take everything we produce in this economy, all the goods, the stuff, right? The lawn furniture and the cars and the water heaters, and you take all the services, all the travel companies and consulting businesses and landscapers, you roll all of that in together, and you get something called gross domestic product, GDP, the three letters to which I referred. That is a tad oversimplified, that definition, but it's close, and we lead with it today because GDP, the closest proxy we really have for the entire economy, grew at an annualized rate of 4.9% in the third quarter, so said the Commerce Department this morning. And 4.9%, just to be clear, is a lot. If you ignore the weirdness of the pandemic recovery, it's the highest quarterly economic growth rate this country has seen in almost a decade. Now, how did that happen? Well, the answer should be pretty familiar to regular listeners of this program. Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us going with the ever-resilient American consumer.
Fitch Ratings economist Olu Sinola is one of the experts I'll call when we get some big data release that says consumers are still spending like crazy. And for the last year or so, the interviews typically go like this. I ask how much longer the economy can be this good with inflation and those Fed rate hikes. And he basically says not much longer.
Olu, how many times have we had a version of this conversation?
A lot of times. And every single time, you always have to say, this is not sustainable. And that's what I have to say again today.
Bumps in government spending and exports helped boost GDP this past quarter, but the real story was the consumer. Almost 60% of that GDP growth came from us, splurging on concerts and restaurants and durable goods, which is where Sinola sees an eventual slowdown.
Durable goods. Typically, you finance them. Motor vehicles, furniture. So if you look at the interest rate environment, it's much, much higher. And there's a limit to what you can put on your credit card.
Sinola is in a group of economists that think the past summer was pretty much the last hurrah of consumer splurging. In the coming months, higher rates will finally hit pocketbooks. Although there's another camp.
I'm not convinced that it's a last hurrah. I think it's just a hurrah. I think we just had a good time over the summer.
Allison Litke teaches macroeconomics at St. Olaf College.
Wage growth is outpacing inflation. And I think people are looking into the fourth quarter of the year and saying, I'm going to have to start paying my loans again. But I also got a raise. I got a new job.
Not that you can't use inflation as an excuse to trim back some of your holiday shopping. Sorry, Timmy. Jay Powell says you can't have that Xbox you wanted. How about we buy you a nice treasury bond instead? I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Sorry, Timmy. Oh, man. The American economy, big though it is just one slice of the global economic pie. And while the United States has been outperforming expectations throughout the bounce back from the pandemic, a whole lot of the rest of the world... not really. Germany, the fourth largest economy on the planet, posted zero growth earlier this year. Canada even saw some contraction. So why is that? Anna Swanson covers, among other things, the global economy for the New York Times. She's here on Fridays every now and then. Hi, Anna.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's ask the basic question. Why is America outperforming, do you think?
Yeah. So the U.S. really looks like an engine of global growth right now. And that has a lot to do with the outsized response that the U.S. had to the pandemic, both in terms of government spending and stimulus from the Fed. It also has a lot to do with the U.S. being insulated from some of the bigger global shocks that we're seeing right now, like the disruption that the war with Russia has caused for energy markets. But yeah, meanwhile, other parts of the world are experiencing a lot more trouble, particularly Europe and China.
Yeah, we'll get to China in a second. But do you suppose, though, that the rest of the world is going to catch up if, as some of the people Matt was just talking to, American growth kind of slows down?
Well, I mean, it does seem like the United States is facing some pretty strong headwinds that can cause growth to decelerate in the coming months. People's savings are running out. Oil prices have been moving higher. Yeah, I mean, I think our economy cannot necessarily defy gravity forever. Maybe there will be a bit more convergence coming up. But then again, you know, you have other geopolitical risks emerging too, like this new conflict in Israel and right. Questions about what that's going to mean for global energy markets and other places around the world.
Right. So talk for a second, though, would you, about that thing you mentioned in the first answer, which is America as engine of global economic growth. I guess my poorly phrased question a second ago was really should have been, can America keep driving the global economy if everybody else isn't keeping up? You know what I mean?
I see. Yeah. Well, I had an interesting conversation today with Mark Zandi, the economist at Moody's, and he was talking about, you know, why the U.S. is so particularly strong. And one thing he said that, you know, Americans are more comfortable spending money now than people in many other countries because we're more insulated from higher interest rates because of something called the 30-year mortgage. So I, you know, my point is, you know, there are some particular reasons in the United States why we are more insulated than other places. And the U.S. has also been, you know, like we were saying, more insulated from energy shocks that hammered Europe following the Russian invasion. So there are, you know, there are reasons the U.S. economy is so strong right now.
Right. And also the United States is a huge energy exporter as well, like natural gas to Europe and all of that stuff.
That's right. We've definitely benefited from that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk China here for a second. They are trying to change their economy to a more domestically consumption-driven model. They are having some challenges post-COVID. They have huge youth unemployment challenges. They are, however, the second biggest economy on the planet. And if they don't do so well, maybe the rest of us don't do so well. And you know, you have lived and worked over there. What do you see for them?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, China is really struggling right now. They're still struggling with the consequences of these prolonged lockdowns and the pandemic, the weaker consumer confidence that stemmed from all of that, and particularly this very big government debt overhang that has to do with how they've driven their economy for a long time. And then you also have, you know, geopolitical tensions on top of that. And that seems like it's having a further chilling effect on the relationship. You're seeing more and more, you know, signs of declining foreign investment in China, Chinese people trying to move their money out of the country. So for now, the story does not look particularly bright there. Mm-hmm.
Super quick, in the half a minute we have left, how much do you think the U.S. is benefiting by inflation having come down here so much faster than it has in the rest of the developed world, most specifically in Europe?
I definitely think that is fueling spending somewhat. Mm-hmm. The GDP release that you saw out today had some signs that prices might have been a little weaker than we had anticipated, which might be fueling consumption. But we'll see, you know, where that goes from here.
Yeah, we will see where it goes from here. Anna Swanson at the New York Times. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
Wall Street today. Look, GDP, schmeDP. Traders took a look at this morning's report and took no solace. Let me tell you that. Tech down hard again today. Other major indices off as well. Not quite as hard, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Gross domestic product got all the economic headlines today here as well, actually, as it usually does. But this being a Thursday, we also got an update on the labor market, the still tight labor market, I should properly say. First-time claims for unemployment benefits came out this morning, up just a tetch, but still historically low. And that, the overall strength of the American labor market, has led to what economists have come to call labor hoarding, where companies keep workers on staff just in case. But just in case of what? Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall explains.
In the latest Beige Book, the Dallas Federal Reserve mentioned scattered reports of labor hoarding. Dan Kaplan at organizational consulting firm Korn Ferry prefers a different term.
I would say it's strategic retention.
Strategic, because companies facing short-term slumps in revenues see that immediately cutting staff may do more harm than good.
You have the natural cost of the layoff, the severance payments, anything, you know, benefits. And then you have the cost of having to pay agency fills to refill position.
Not to mention the lost revenue when business suddenly picks up and you need to hire someone like now. Economist Selchik Aaron is with the Conference Board.
It wasn't that easy for many companies to hire back workers after the massive layoffs during the pandemic, right? A lot of industries are still feeling the heat.
Especially sectors like food and beverage and hospitality, says Luke Pardue with payroll firm Gusto.
They're actually still the least likely to let go of their workers. In those services, we've seen termination rates fall the most over the past year.
Businesses are also holding on to consulting and tech talent, says economist Julia Pollack with ZipRecruiter.
And so the big consulting firms and the big banks are in many cases hanging on to their Ivy League graduate new hires who don't have that much work on their plates.
Because for firms who are looking to hire now, it's tough. Mike Steinitz is with talent firm Robert Half.
A typical story is said employer, you know, posts a job. They get a ton of applicants, but the applicants are not qualified.
And the ones that are qualified are, as they say, entertaining other options. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
One of the things that happened in this economy because of the pandemic, one of the many, many things that happened in this economy because of the pandemic, was that undergraduate student enrollment fell by a lot, but no more. For the first time since the before times, undergrad enrollment is up. That's according to data out today from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center, which also shows that community colleges accounted for nearly 60% of that increase, 60%, with enrollment in associate's degree and certificate programs up way more than bachelor's degrees. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looks at why short-term credentials are so sought after right now.
19-year-old Jerry Campbell says he's been interested in HVAC systems since high school.
Nobody wants to be in a hot house. Nobody wants to be in a cold house. You can fix both of those problems, you'll be somebody's favorite.
So Campbell enrolled this fall in a 16th-month HVAC certificate program at a technical college in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a change. This time last fall, Campbell was studying chemistry at a public university with plans to become a doctor. But he decided he didn't want to spend that much money or time on school.
Time is everything. You cannot get it back.
Enrollment in undergraduate certificate programs like Campbell's is up nearly 10% this school year. Associate degrees are up 3.6%. But bachelors are up less than 1%. Doug Shapiro is one of the authors of that new report from the National Student Clearinghouse.
Students are really voting with their feet for shorter term, I think, less expensive credentials with more direct ties to today's workforce.
And there will be jobs waiting for these students once they're done in everything from HVAC to microchip manufacturing. Josh Weiner leads the Aspen Institute's College Excellence Program.
You see Micron coming to New York and Intel coming to Ohio, and those jobs will be coming online in the not-too-distant future. And so we need people who can manufacture those chips.
But Weiner's concerned about the lackluster growth in bachelor's degree enrollment because he says the workforce needs people with those credentials, too.
We have shortages of nurses and teachers and software engineers. All of those jobs require or favor bachelor's degree holders.
Weiner says higher ed's going to need to do a better job of making sure all of these people at technical and community colleges can easily transfer their credits to four-year institutions, so they have a clear path to a bachelor's degree. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
As it happens, David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report have a segment and a newsletter that they call Econ Extra Credit. You should sign up. That's at marketplace.org/newsletters. And you should listen every morning to David and the gang. Check it out. Coming up.
It kind of made me laugh, or else I would cry.
Gotta stay positive somehow. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, day two of the Wawa's Mega Down. The director of this program just whispered in my ear. The Dow Industrials shed 251 points today, 0.75%, ended things at 32,784. That's not the mega part. The NASDAQ down 225 points, 1.75%. We'll call that the mega part, 12,595. The S&P 500 gave up 49 points, almost 1.2% today, ended things at 41.37. Comcast subtracted 8.4%. The telecommunications firm reported a loss of 18,000 broadband subscribers in the third quarter. Advertising revenue from its NBC Universal channels also down. AT&T slipped nearly 0.5%. T-Mobile added 1.3%. Bond prices went down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 4.84%. On this Thursday, you're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is, between the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act, more than $1 trillion at hand to fix and upgrade American infrastructure over the next decade or so. That money comes, though, with a catch. Buy American rules. Rules that have been around for a long while, I should say. They have been expanded now to new kinds of projects and building materials, which means state, local, and tribal governments have to be more careful that what they are spending federal money on was, in fact, made in the United States. And as Marketplace's Savannah Marr found out while she was reporting for our climate podcast, How We Survive, that is holding up some critical projects.
Outside of Sacaton, the capital of the Gila River Indian community, a construction crew is digging a trench. Lengths of bright blue pipe, 4 feet in diameter, are piled up on the work site.
We're putting in about 250 feet a day.
David DeYoung heads up the community's irrigation project. When it's finished, DeYoung says this nearly 20-mile pipeline will help shore up the reservation's water supply by bringing in reclaimed wastewater from the Arizona cities of Mesa and Chandler.
We then can put it into the canal that serves 95% of the community's agricultural land.
The federal government is funding this project with $83 million from the $1 trillion infrastructure law.
In exchange for delivering this reclaimed water, the community will leave a like amount of water in Lake Mead to help conserve water in Lake Mead.
Water the community is entitled to use will instead boost levels in one of the Colorado River's dwindling reservoirs. Lake Mead hit record low levels last year.
When we're at the table, we bring innovations.
That's the Gila River Indian Community's governor, Stephen Rowe Lewis.
We're doing everything we can to model very responsible behavior in regards to how we are using water, how we're conserving water as well, how we're utilizing technology.
But one barrier to conservation has been finding American-made building materials. David DeYoung says that blue pipe was easy to source in compliance with BABA, the Build America, Buy America provision of the infrastructure law. But the fittings to connect the pipes,
We've already spent over $2 million in additional expense we had not anticipated on the fittings because we have to comply with the BABA.
And DeYoung says other materials have been impossible to source in the U.S.
The pumps and motors and electrical switches and gears that we need to operate the pump, we cannot find anybody in the country who will certify that they are 100% American-made.
Buy American policies have been in place for decades, says John Murphy with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
And they have a real impact. 97% of U.S. federal contracts by value have been awarded to U.S. companies in recent years.
Murphy says traditionally, Buy American rules have been limited to materials like iron and steel used in transportation projects, and they've been easy to comply with. But he says the recent expansion of the rules could backfire.
Broadband equipment, water and wastewater treatment equipment, all of these are products where we've seen Buy American rules ratcheted up.
And that Murphy says are mostly made overseas. The infrastructure law includes funding to stimulate domestic production of those materials, but that could take years. For now, Murphy says the expanded rules are generating confusion.
They cause state and local governments to feel they have to lawyer up, and this drives up infrastructure costs dramatically.
Some federal agencies have issued temporary waivers, allowing tribal, local, and state governments more time to adjust, including the Department of the Interior, which oversees some tribal infrastructure projects. The Gila River Indian community is benefiting from that, according to one of its lawyers, Jason Howder.
The United States has a year to consult with tribes before implementing the policy on tribal projects, essentially.
Thanks to that exemption, David DeYoung with the Gila River Irrigation Project says those pumps and motors it needed for its reclaimed water pipeline have finally been purchased, and its ambitious conservation project can move forward. In the Gila River Indian community, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Amy Scott, the host of our podcast, How We Survive, contributed reporting to Savannah's story. There is a new episode out this week, by the way, platform of your choice, as you know. We started today with Matt Levin and third quarter gross domestic product growth. Better than expected is, of course, the macro headline. So looking for economic threads to pull through the show as we do, we end today with a more micro look also about growth, just of a different kind. Here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Mimi Striplin. I am the founder and CEO of The Tiny Tassel, and I'm based in Charleston, South Carolina. I started my business about 8 years ago here in Charleston with an Instagram and an Etsy shop. I started with a collection of handmade tassel earrings, and it's evolved over the years from Etsy selling to my own platform and now a flagship store located in downtown Charleston. And we have everything from our handmade tassel jewelry to clothing that my mom designs and really beautiful gifts that we source from local Black women-led brands. Over the years, we've seen lots of increases from our shipping providers, our suppliers, and we have really tried to adjust accordingly without passing that cost along to our customers. Gosh, some of the expenses that have come up over the years kind of make me laugh, or else I would cry. We've seen everything from our postal services increasing shipping costs to even our shipping boxes, our threads and things that we're buying from our wholesalers that supply craft supplies. There's also other things like who is paying the electric bill to a storefront in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, where it gets 100 degrees in the summer for multiple days at a time. Like, those are the things that you don't quite think of firsthand when you are planning to open a storefront. It makes us get creative in where we can cut costs in other places of our business. And it may look like cleaning our storefront windows instead of having a professional window cleaner come once a month, and really getting
back to the basics of like, what can we do in-house that is going to cut some of our costs so that our prices to our customers don't have to skyrocket? It was certainly a huge risk that I took as a business owner to decide, okay, I'm going to commit to this storefront. And I'm so glad that I did. As a Black and Japanese woman in the South, I felt that there was such a need to create a space for people that looked like me or that wanted to support people that looked like me. And I wanted to create that more than ever, to have a space that was welcoming to all.
That's Mimi Striplin there, founder and CEO of the Tiny Tassel in Charleston, South Carolina. We do want to know what's going on with you, your economic day-to-day, small business or otherwise. You can tell us, we wish you would, at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, the Department of Justice said today that 9% of people in this country over the age of 16 have been the victims of identity theft. Now, lest you be thinking that, yeah, Kai, that's not great, but still, it means 91% have not been. The raw numbers are that more than 23 million people have been victimized. Bank accounts, obviously, are the most common targets. Total dollar amount losses, more than $16 billion. All right, we're off. Here is your quick moment of economic context, a quick data point to bookend Matt Levin's report on consumers still propping up this economy. Amazon reported today profits tripled in the July through September quarter, almost $10 billion profit in 3 months, $10 billion 3 months. Combination of cloud computing and its ad businesses and, oh yes, e-commerce. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Cardi at the Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Mir Babawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.